Hey everyone, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
All right, we're going to start the show today by playing a little visualization game with you guys.
Okay.
All right, here we go. All right, everyone, close your eyes.
If you're not driving.
If you're not driving, close your eyes. If you are driving, do not participate literally with us right now. Figuratively.
Close your eyes.
Close your eyes. All right, in all seriousness, here we go. Close your eyes and imagine what a wealthy neighborhood looks like. All right, give you a couple seconds here. So, what came to mind?
We're guessing. Maybe leafy trees, nice houses, amenities, parks, businesses. But probably not abandoned buildings, barren streets, and empty lots.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, those things are often associated with quote-unquote poor neighborhoods.
Okay, let's do one more visualization. We want you to imagine a neighborhood that doesn't have much money, but looks like a neighborhood with money. Having trouble seeing this one? You're not alone.
Yeah, in the community development world, it's widely understood that bringing any kind of change to a struggling neighborhood can take years. Yet at the same time, the need for change is urgent.
Research suggests blight is associated with serious health problems.
Yeah, not to mention the stress associated with poverty.
So what happens when you try to make sure being poor doesn't mean a life surrounded by decay?
On today's episode, we bring you three very different stories about people with a common goal, changing the look of poverty.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Camille Stanley.
And I'm Tim Lloyd. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here. Our first story starts bright and early. It's 7 in the morning and St. Louis is just starting to wake up.
But Melvin White, he's just ending his shift at the downtown post office. His eyes are heavy and he's clutching a cup of coffee.
Hey, good morning.
Melvin is a clerk at the post office. He's worked there for 2 decades. And for the past 6 years, he's pulled the graveyard shift.
Now, this isn't because Melvin's a natural night owl. Working overnights lets Melvin spend his days on his real passion.
I go home, give me a couple hours of rest, and then I do my beloved streets, you know, get started on community work. So, yeah.
Community work is an understatement. Melvin has a big, bold plan to transform part of the city where he grew up, along Martin Luther King Drive in North St. Louis.
Like a lot of streets named after the civil rights leader, it runs through a part of the city that is mostly black and has suffered through decades of disinvestment. And there's a lot of St. Louis that looks this way. A bit disheveled, a bit neglected, call it blight or hard times, but Melvin is among many people in this city who say they're tired of looking at ugly streets, vacant lots, and grimy sidewalks. They want to change the look of poverty from the outside in. So a couple hours after that first encounter, we meet back up with Melvin at his other office.
Excuse the building. It needs a lot of work, so that's why we're trying to get the money to redo this whole
thing. This is the headquarters for Beloved Streets of America, a nonprofit Melvin started several years ago.
There are holes in the ceiling. The paint is peeling on the walls, and the back of the building is starting to fall down. But Melvin sees past all that.
As you can look around, it's abandoned buildings and boarded up buildings, and that's not what Dr. King stood for. He stood for beauty. I mean, this man did a lot to help with civil rights, race relations, and to be represented in the negative aspects that we're looking at. It's not fitting for a man who gave his life to uplift the communities across the country. So we have to get that facelift in order to represent what he stood for.
Melvin's dream is to start that facelift by transforming the vacant lot across the streets into a park. And he also wants to see a monument to honor Dr. King along with black luminaries from St. Louis. Melvin sees this vacant lot as sort of a proof of concept. If he can get some traction here, he hopes it will give him the foothold he needs to move forward. From there, he wants to revitalize the building he's standing in and others around it.
The price tag to do this, he says, would be $2 million. Beyond that, Melvin wants to clean up MLK streets across the country. And for that, he says he needs $1 billion. This ambitious idea has gotten Melvin lots of headlines, but not a lot of cash. About a year ago, to save money, he cut off the electricity to his office. But he's not giving up. A few weeks after we first met him, Melvin and some volunteers are back at the nonprofit headquarters.
As Melvin and his crew sweep away hypodermic needles and broken glass, area residents begin to take notice.
Yeah, so we're trying to bring back Dr. King's legacy in a positive light by cleaning these streets up, bringing jobs back, social programs for people that's trying to get off drugs and so on and so forth. So we just need your support, though. When you see us out there, grab a broom and help us clean up, you know?
I will.
Yeah, that's what we, you know, that's what our mission is. So.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Ain't too many people who do that. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
Melvin says moments like this keep him going.
Like I said, our thing is it's not a black thing, it's the right thing. And that's the movement that we're pushing right now.
But creating a true movement and actually getting it to go forward, that's easier said than done. Fortunately, not far from Melvin Street, other St. Louis residents are seeing the fruits of their struggles, literally.
Story number two takes us to Fresh Starts Community Garden in the Jeff Vanderloo neighborhood of North St. Louis. In the 1800s, the city designated this neighborhood as a strictly Negro district. Was one of the few areas of town where blacks were allowed to own real estate. Today, Jeff Vanderloo remains almost entirely black, and 60% of the people in this zip code live below the poverty line. The nearest grocery store is a 17-minute walk away.
But pull up to the 2900 block of Dayton Street, and you see an acre of green. We're looking for a woman named Rosie Willis, who runs this garden. People from all over the city speak of her like a legend. But instead of Rosie, we come across this scene. Three ladies crouch beside what appears to be an overgrown vine, using an old pair of pantyhose to support a vegetable I've never seen in my life.
See, and so now
see what we're tying up?
It should be supported.
What is that?
That's called kushaw.
A what?
It's a kushaw squash.
It's a kushaw squash. It's similar to like pumpkin and stuff, but I think it's a little sweeter. I think it is between like a pumpkin and a summer squash, probably.
That last voice is Sarah Humphreys. She's never gardened until 3 years ago.
Never. I thought I had no kind of green thumb because I've killed every houseplant I have ever had in my apartment. But Rosie just taught me the basics. And I've just been going and learning from there. And these ladies, this is their first season and they're as pro as me, so.
Sarah and her friends Debbie and Julie now spend Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings growing, harvesting, and weeding this garden.
It's honestly a treasure of the neighborhood.
But Sarah says in order to really appreciate what's here now, you have to know what this place looked like 7 years ago.
When she took over, this was an empty lot, if you can see right there, which I know your podcast people can't see, but that is an abandoned building, which is losing the back half. That was basically the same here. When we dig, there's still foundations from houses we find. Like, we have to pick up bricks and shit. Oh, sorry, under the dirt. there was no real vegetation. There was no fence. There were no sidewalks. There was no shed, there were no water sources. We used to have to hook a hose up from Rosie's house and try to drag it over to water or fill up buckets to water. Like, it was basically barren and nothing, and it has slowly transformed and gained support. But it's truthfully pretty much Rosie and her son that have done that.
I mean, you guys even have a porta potty in the back.
Yeah, which came two seasons ago.
I can't wait to meet her. I mean, she sounds like she inspires you guys.
She does, yeah. You will. When you meet her, you will understand.
We take Sarah's advice and come back 2 days later to meet the lady everybody has been gushing about, Rosie.
Come right in, and you two know where you can start because you've been here before.
Yes, we have.
Come right in.
It's a beautiful garden.
Well, you know, right now, it's to me, it's beautiful when we can get all this grass cut.
High grass notwithstanding, Rosie gets straight to her favorite thing, showing off all the various fruits, veggies, flowers, and plants growing here.
I just kind of want to know what all we're growing out here, okay?
We've got like four different peppers. This is the cowhorn, Serrano, Hungarian wax.
Okay, see, this is a part of my breakfast. This is one of my gardens. all this Swiss chard, I mean all this kale. And what I'm gonna do with this, I'm gonna freeze it. Have you ever seen clammy spinach?
No.
Look at that.
Incredible.
We don't use any kind of
pesticide,
chemicals. Our garden is absolutely an organic garden. And you see,
Rosie grew up with gardens, usually planting small ones in her own yard. She's lived in Jeff Vanderloo for 47 years. But in 2007, after closing her home daycare business, she found herself with a lot more free time. She thought of joining an already established community garden in a different part of St. Louis. But then she looked around.
Now it's coming down my back steps. Why am I going to go join another garden that's already beautiful? We got all this mess around us, these old lots with all kinds of trash and drug paraphernalia and anything you want to name, multiplied by 100 times on these lots, okay?
One of those empty, trashy lots was just steps from Rosie's home.
So I'm going to see what can we do about this piece of land over here.
Turns out the city owned the land. Rosie convinced officials to lease the vacant lot to her for $1 a year as long as she followed through on her plan to start a community garden. The neighbors were on board, but Rosie knew she needed money to get started.
Remember, there were no water lines for irrigation, no fence to keep the place secure, no shed for tools.
Then I started on my alderman. We had a great alderman then, about asking for, you know, we're trying to have this garden and we need some money. Hello there, another gardener. We need some money. We need money to get this garden going. What can you do to help us? And she said, well, Rosie, I don't know. We don't have money for a project like that. Okay, I let that soak in a little bit with her. Then I sent her another email. But what about community development, that money? Isn't there some money for community development? Well, I don't know. I'll look into that. Every time I asked her a question, it was, I don't know. I'll look into that, okay?
Rosie started to get some results after meeting a college student who drew up plans for what the garden could look like. That, finally, got city officials out to the vacant lot.
So she came out with somebody else from the city, okay? Them one of these city community development organization. They came out, they had their little high heel shoes on, walking around out here in the dirt, their little suits on. I was looking like somebody's scarecrow. So one of the ladies said, well, I think we can give you a three-sided fence. So I said, you know, I don't have anything against animals. I have nothing against people who love dogs. But would you actually go out and buy a three-legged dog? How do you think that a three-sided fence is going to help us? Every small kid in the neighborhood will come and destroy our garden anytime they wanted to. Then when I started talking about a shed, then they started telling me something about they could give me, one of those little prefab plastic deal sheds. So no, we don't want that. We don't want something that is easy to break into. And I said, because we are looking forward to having really expensive tools in that shed.
And Rosie did finally get that four-sided fence and a nice big industrial shed. She put in a picnic table and a pergola.
Then a couple high school kids put a roof on the structure so gardeners have shade from the sun. Sarah Humphreys, the volunteer who spends most mornings in the garden, says it's obvious Rosie's simple pledge to start a garden has grown into something much more.
Everybody that walks by, everybody from young kids to old people, wave at us, ask us what we're harvesting today, ask how Rosie is, yell hello. Like, everybody knows it. Everybody stops by. People respect it, even if they're not in here gardening. The young kids that are doing other stuff around here and playing basketball will get defensive if people try to, like, disrespect or encroach on the garden. Like, it's just known. We love Rosie. We love this garden. It's part of our neighborhood. And whether we're actually there helping or not, everybody looks out for it.
Sarah's not exaggerating. Everyone who comes to Fresh Starts is riveted. By its size, it's nearly an acre and has room for 50 beds.
And its impact. Hundreds of pounds of fresh vegetables, fruits, and herbs are harvested each year.
And lastly, its community. Rosie only charges people $20 a year to rent space in the garden.
She refuses to raise the price, in part so people in the neighborhood can afford to garden. Rosie says she wants to show people they don't always have to look elsewhere for progress.
You don't have to run 100 miles away from anything because you think you're going to what is better. Move in an era like this and make better. So that's why I'm here.
It's also why others are drawn to Fresh Starts. which was just named the best hangout garden by the city's largest urban agriculture nonprofit, Gateway Greening.
Because 7 years after deciding to transform the vacant lot across the street, Rosie doesn't have a problem convincing people of the garden's worth. These days, city officials flock to the garden, as they did recently for an annual candlelight dinner Rosie hosts.
Well, Rosie Willis is a force of nature. She's a dynamo.
Sal Martinez helps Rosie run the garden. In fact, his company, Community Renewal and Development, wrote the grant that got them the porta potty.
She wowed me with her passion and commitment to growing this garden and doing something to address the fact that Jeff Vanderloo is a food desert. And so she convinced me right away because she is willing to put in the work. She probably works 50 plus hours a week in the garden and on the weekend.
Fresh Starts has bloomed into much more than a food source for Rosie's neighborhood.
A teen girl who lives a few blocks away works part-time here. Police officers, firefighters, and other government officials use the garden as a neutral meeting spot to connect with residents. And people from all over the city sign up for plots.
Martinez, who's been trying to improve Jeff Vanderloo for more than a decade, calls Fresh Starts a major part of the neighborhood's redevelopment.
Ms. Willis has provided hope for people in the community that there is a better tomorrow, and this garden stands as a symbol of that.
Meanwhile, Rosie says she's not done and has her eyes set on another plot, the one right next to the garden.
She believes the crumbling vacant house that sits there now could be renovated. Then something useful could go inside, a commercial kitchen, a community meeting room, a museum. And just like she did with the garden, Rosie says she's planting that seed of an idea with city officials right now. St. Louis is full of people like Rosie, who see a problem as an opportunity for change. But that wellspring of good intentions can be tamped down under the weight of a divided region. Our next story gets to that right after the break. As we've mentioned on this show countless times, St. Louis County is kind of like a giant jigsaw puzzle. The single county of 1 million people contains almost 90 municipalities.
Just a quick point of clarification for folks not familiar with the St. Louis area. St. Louis City, where we met Melvin and Rosie, is different from St. Louis County.
And critics say St. Louis County's patchwork of police departments and courts has a real and sometimes negative impact on Black and poor residents.
On top of that, decades of white flight and disappearing jobs have left many of the tiny suburbs in North St. Louis County struggling to make ends meet. Some people say the solution to all of this is getting these communities to start sharing resources. But getting a blueprint together to do that has been tough.
And we begin our third and final story today with a guy who's actually started building one of these blueprints.
Hi, I'm Chris Kramer, President and CEO of Beyond Housing.
We met up with Chris recently in a North St. Louis County parking lot. The community development nonprofit he runs, Beyond Housing, does work in the area.
For us, it's, yeah, the physical place you live every day, but it's really about the life in and around where you live that we think fuels and draws the best out of the people that live there.
Beyond Housing has been around since 1975. But 6 years ago, the housing crisis prompted it to launch something called 24-1. It's an association of 24 separate municipalities in North St. Louis County that pool their resources.
They've built things like a grocery store, a senior living facility, even a movie theater. Now, some of you close listeners may remember Chris from one of our shows on affordable housing. But he's been working on something we didn't have time to tell you about in that show.
24-1 now has its own forester, which seems a little odd, right? Like, but here's the deal: this is an older community with lots of older, mature trees. So, as a general rule, most communities who don't have a lot of resources view trees as a liability, right? Because the only time they deal with them is when they fall. In addition, and again, this is all stuff that we get to learn. I never even thought of mature, healthy trees save your pavement. Because they're shielding it from the heat of the sun. They're good for the sewer system because they're taking a lot of water out of the sewer system. So there's great financial benefits for communities to have strong, healthy trees.
A couple years ago, a consulting company tallied up all the benefits of the public trees in about half of the 24 little towns Chris works with. And it put the value of these trees at more than $7 million.
But again, this isn't a wealthy area, and a lot of these little towns don't have much money to take care of these aging trees. So Beyond Housing applied for a grant from the Missouri Department of Conservation and got one last year to hire this guy.
We need to figure out where we're going to get the most bang for the buck and what is most important, most critical at this point in time.
Doug Seeley, an easygoing guy with a stocky build, is Beyond Housing's new community forester. And he spends his days searching for and documenting the sickest trees in the area, like this one, which looks like it could fall on top of the warehouse we're standing next to.
After looking at the tree, you can see there's some brown leaves on it. So the tree was still alive this spring and it leafed out. And what happens is, with it being an American elm, it's probably succumbed to Dutch elm disease.
Doug says some problem trees like this one are easy to spot, but most are hidden. A couple of streets over, he leans down and pulls back the ivy at the base of a different tree.
You can see that the ivy is hiding a huge cavity in the base of the tree. This tree should be removed. We should have never spent the money on pruning this tree.
Did you catch that part about pruning? 2 years ago, a few towns around here got some tree work done, which sounds good, but not all the work was done correctly.
So when something like a thunderstorm hits, those trees are more likely to fall down, destroy property. Then there's all the extra money already cash-strapped towns have to spend to remove fallen trees. That in turn means there's less money to plant new trees.
Bottom line, it's a mess that Doug, a certified arborist, now has to clean up. And his attention to detail has already earned him a growing fan club among local officials like Mary Louise Carter.
And I think I've been pestering you more than anybody, haven't I?
I always call it pestering.
A little bit. Because, if a tree, I don't even know when a tree is dead. A tree can be leafing and be gone.
Carter is the mayor of Pagedale. It's a tiny city with around 3,300 residents. There's not a lot of money in Pagedale, and Carter's budget is tight. So having somebody with Doug's credentials, whose salary she doesn't have to worry about, is a big, big deal.
And this is something we have never had in our area. We're constantly cutting because we got one to cut down now. Yeah. And, here and there. And if you're constantly cutting and never replant, your city's going to be bare after a while.
A local forestry nonprofit has offered to donate trees to all the towns. And Doug is walking Carter through her options. She says this kind of thing hasn't happened around here for a long, long time.
What do you hear from your other mayors, your colleagues?
Everybody want to plant. Belder yeah. City. See, we never had any concentrated planting within the last 15, 20 years. But I've been constantly cutting them down as they die. So this is going to mean a lot for the entire area. And when you really get the planting, you will begin to see the impact of it if it's over a wide area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So far, so good. Some small governments spot a problem, come together, get some money, and begin working toward a solution.
But not so fast. Doug's about to hit a snag. Because now that he's cataloged all the problems left behind from that bad tree work done in the past, he now has to deliver some bad news to Urvetta Williams, his boss at Beyond Housing.
Just kind of going by the pre-bids that I got on the information and the bidding that was done, kind of came up with the $11,112.50 to do all the removals and the prunings. So that would leave us with $16,700.
And this is just to fix the trees?
Correct.
No, that's... We've got other municipalities, and we have dollars we need to stretch. So let's stretch them some more.
Let us explain what just went down. Doug wants to spend about $1 in $3 they have for the entire year just to fix a handful of trees. Not the most appealing option, considering there are thousands and thousands of other trees in other towns that need attention.
So like his boss tells him to do, Doug goes back to the drawing board and gets creative. About a week later, we meet back up with him. He wants to show us a tiny victory.
We're looking to see if the stump was totally removed, that elm tree that they removed a couple weeks ago.
We walk toward a pile of mulch. This is what's left of the very first problem tree Doug showed us. It's the one that looked like it was going to fall on the warehouse. And if you've ever had to get a tree removed, you know, it can get pretty expensive. But Doug was able to cobble together the money by convincing the property owner and the city to chip in.
And now he's thinking about what kind of tree he can plant in its place.
All those little bitty steps and things that we can do as a group to try and solve our overall problem of where are we going to get the money from.
One at a time.
One at a time. That's right. We can't build Rome overnight, right?
Yeah.
Now, it's totally understandable if you're thinking to yourself, all right, a tree was cut down. Isn't that so nice? Thank you for walking me through that whole story and the tree was cut down. What's the big deal? What are you guys getting at here?
Yeah, but, stick with us, guys.
Yeah, right, yeah. So before you reach that conclusion, we're going to take you back to that street corner where we met Chris Kramer. He's the guy who got all these municipalities to start sharing resources in the first place around 6 years ago.
He is, and their first big accomplishment wasn't a new building or a sweeping economic program. It was getting a better deal on something wealthier communities often take for granted.
Rock salt, as you know, as inane as that seems. Well, who knew that there was a Chesterfield co-op that got rock salt off the Missouri River that most affluent communities knew about, but most low-income communities didn't?
Wow.
And our folks were literally paying 40% more for their rock salt per ton. And all that was just sharing of information, right? That wasn't, I got to give up anything, right? No,
just getting people to talk to
each
other.
Yeah. As simple as that, right?
Chris says getting people to work together gave them a simple, tangible sign that changing habits could be worth the sacrifice, which can carry over into much, much larger projects. For example, just this month, officials announced an effort to merge 7 municipal courts in some of the towns Chris works with.
And while Chris says the big stuff gets headlines and feels good, none of it is possible if you don't get the small stuff right. Even if it's just figuring out how to cut down one sick tree and plant a new one in its place.
Look, so much of his work is 3 yards in a cloud of dust,
yeah.
Right? We do fancy ribbon cuttings for big buildings, which is great, right?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's about building relationships. I mean, the language we use is community building happens at the speed of trust. And trust is not given, it's earned every day, every day, every day.
When you think about all the things a region like St. Louis is grappling with, racial and economic divides, outdated systems of government, and the legacy of bad policy decisions, frankly, changing the look of poverty often feels like it belongs at the bottom of the priority list.
But that's being challenged by people like Melvin White, who believes a facelift to a street named after a civil rights icon will jumpstart redevelopment of a struggling neighborhood.
By Rosie Willis, who transformed a vacant lot into a lush corner garden that helps feed her city.
And by Beyond Housing, which is trying to help tiny cities in North St. Louis County band together to protect an unexpected asset, trees. Because whether it's one street, one garden, or even one tree, it gets easier to imagine the possibility of change when you begin to see it take root.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our editor.
And Cassie Morgan composed our theme music.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.